ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
For millennia, philosophers and scientists have grappled with the question of the origin of life. Theories for an unguided naturalistic origin of life have come and gone over the years, with each new proposal critiquing the one before it until it too, in turn, collapses in light of the evidence. Hello, I'm Eric Anderson, and today I'm pleased to be joined by Dr. Brian Miller to discuss another theory for the origin of life that has been making the rounds. We'll look at the positives and the negatives of this new proposal and see how it stacks up. Dr. Miller is research coordinator at the Center for Science and Culture at Discovery Institute in Seattle, Washington. He holds a bachelor's degree in physics with a minor in engineering from MIT and a PhD in physics from Duke University. He has spoken internationally on the topics of intelligent design and the origin of life. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Brian, I'm really thrilled to have you on today. I've appreciated your thoughtful and insightful approach to these issues over the years, and it's great to have your background in physics and engineering as we tackle this topic and review a proposal made by another physicist. So I'm really looking forward to getting your insights.
Yes, I'm very looking forward to our conversation.
Part of what we'll be discussing today has to do with thermodynamics, which is an area you've researched in some detail. Before we dive in, I just want to explain one thing to our audience. Many of our listeners who are longtime observers of the origin of life debate will be familiar with discussions about thermodynamics, including some of the nonsense attempts to support a naturalistic origin of life by reference to the old Earth is an open system line of argumentation. Sometimes those discussions about thermodynamics have tended to generate more heat than light, pun intended, and some people might be put off by the whole discussion of thermodynamics. For any of you who might be in that category, I invite you to sit back and enjoy today's discussion because we're talking about things a little bit differently today, something a little more sophisticated. Well, I guess we'll find out whether this proposal is really more substantive or not, but the argument and the way it's laid out might be new to a lot of people and is getting a lot of press, and we'll definitely be hearing more about this proposal. Brian, to start off, just give us a little background on this proposal and how you got involved.
Oh, sure. What happened is Jeremy England was a professor at MIT. He's now at Georgia Tech, and he works with what's called non-equilibrium thermodynamics. And that's a very fancy word, but it just means that you have some system and you're driving that system far from equilibrium through some energy source or some field or some force. And a classic example is that if you have a pot of water and you heat the water from below, what happens is you've got energy that flows through that water. The energy enters the bottom, leaves the top, and then that flow of energy will create certain order, certain patterns, like the roll patterns in boiling water. Mm-hmm. And Jeremy England has done some pretty sophisticated research on this topic. And what he's found is that when you have a system driven far from equilibrium, that system can adjust in ways to more efficiently absorb energy from the outside and then release it. And what happened is he noticed that that's kind of what life does. Life is a system, in a sense, that will very efficiently absorb energy from the outside, like sunlight or chemical energy from glucose. It'll then release heat, but in the process, it uses that energy to maintain its order or to even create new order, such as cell replication. So he was billed as someone who's created a physics theory for the origin of life. That's what he's noted for.
Yeah, and this isn't completely new, although a lot of people may not have heard of this. I remember back in January 2014, when he first came out with this theory, he got a lot of press and Quantum magazine picked up the story. And I believe he's now developed this into a new book, which was published last fall.
That's correct. And it's not entirely new, because you have people like Prigogine, who pioneered some of these ideas mm-hmm. of self-organization, and other people have worked with things like the maximum entropy theorems. But what he did is he connected it to life in a way that hasn't really been done before. And he consolidated his ideas in a book that's called Every Life on Fire, How Thermodynamics Explains the Origin of Living Things. And he had some very interesting insights in that book.
Right. So from the official book description at Amazon, it says, England explains how counterintuitively, the very same forces that tend to tear things apart assembled the first living systems. Every life on fire is a profound testament to how something can come from nothing. All right, that sounds like a pretty ambitious claim. Let's see how that stacks up. So let's start with the positive, Brian. First, tell me what you liked about England's book.
Well, what he talked about in his book is how natural processes will either tend to drive things to disorder Like if you have a clean room, that'll tend to become a messy room. So that's a very strong drive in nature. And that's the technical term is to go from low entropy to high entropy. And entropy can often be described as disorder, although that's not a perfect description. And also, nature tends to go from high energy to low energy. And England illustrated that very beautifully in his book. And he talked about how what happens with life is sort of the opposite of that. That although most processes move things to either greater disorder or lower energy, life is at a state of very high order, very low entropy, and a state of very high energy. And the only way that can happen is if there's some energy source that acts like an escalator, that's the term he used, to keep moving the system back to that state of low entropy and high energy and working against all the forces trying to break it apart. So I thought that was a beautiful insight he had that he described in very nice terms.
So tell us a little bit about how living systems overcome these thermodynamic challenges.
Sure. So what England also talked about in his book is the way that life deals with these challenges is it has lots of very complex machinery. A classic example would be enzymes. And an enzyme is just a type of protein. And a protein is this very long chain of amino acids. And the amino acids, there's 20 of them, are in a very specific sequence that causes that chain to fold in a particular three-dimensional structure. And then that molecular machine, what it can do is it can repair, let's say, a protein that's starting to unfold, or it can repair the cell membrane that's breaking apart, or it can build new machines if necessary. So what happens in life is you have all this highly sophisticated machinery that keeps undoing the damage from thermal fluctuations that are breaking the cell apart. In addition, what happens is a cell has machinery like ATP synthase, and that machinery creates energy in a form that the cell can use, like ATP. Mm-hmm. And then these enzymes also can extract that energy from those energy sources and use it to power processes in the direction that's opposite of what they would normally do. So it can move things to, let's say, higher energy or greater order when that normally would not happen. So England talks about how a lot of this goes back to the information in these protein sequences. So again, that he described that in very nice terms.
Right. Yeah. And we'll come back to this point about how the energy is captured and put into usable form, because that's really key. But before that, how does England believe all this cellular machinery came about?
Yes. And that's the place where our views diverge. So what England argues is that if you've got energy and or mass flowing through a system, what can happen is that system can self-organize in such a way to maintain a particular type of order. And what can happen is it can direct the energy in a very specific channel to help maintain that order. And then other ways that energy might disrupt the system are blocked. So that's this idea of self-organization that I mentioned. And he argues that that could explain how structures in life formed that could help maintain the order in the cell. That's the logic.
And what kinds of examples does he give to try to justify that claim?
All right. And he fully acknowledges that he doesn't have any real examples of how this would work in the context of origin of life. So he's describing it more as something that's an analogy. But he does have a lot of examples in actual experiments where it happens. So for instance, he created a simulation of beads, which are connected through springs. And what happened is one of those beads is forced to move by a oscillating force. And then that energy spreads through the system. And as that energy spreads, the interaction of these various beads will self-organize in such a way to more efficiently draw energy out of the source of energy and then release it into the environment as heat. Another experiment he describes is these spheres that have light projected on it of a particular frequency and a magnetic field that's applied. And what happens is these spheres can then self-organize into sort of crystalline type structures. So he's pointing to these examples of experiments where you do see self-organization through the flow of energy through the system. And that's how he justifies the idea that it might happen with life.
Right. Yeah. And it seems like a real, you know, just looking at it from the outside, at my viewpoint, it seems like a real misunderstanding of the difference between functional organization and mere order. But tell me about your views. Did you find his explanation convincing?
I think his research is amazing and very insightful, but it doesn't really apply to life. And as you just said, the problem is that the analogies break down pretty quickly. Because if you look at all of these experiments or the simulations that he does, he had to design the simulations, or an experimenter had to design the experiments very specifically to cause a proper matching between the energy source and the system to create the order that the researcher desired. So again, it's the information that goes into the specific constraints of the experiments that allow that matching to take place to create the order. Now, in contrast, if you look at, let's say, the early Earth, and you look at all the energy sources that could have potentially driven the origin of life, things like sunlight, thermal vents with proton gradients, or high energy chemicals, or tsunamis that create pulses of sound. And then you look at what sort of chemicals these energy sources directly make, like formaldehyde. What you find is that neither the energy sources nor the chemicals they directly make have any connection to virtually any biological process. Like, it doesn't connect to the structures, it doesn't connect to the chemical pathways that take place. So What can happen is the energy sources can do a lot of different things, and they're not directly fine-tuned to work with life. That's the big problem.
Yeah, so they're unconnected with the kinds of reactions and structures that we need and seem to be. I mean, you can have interesting results from oscillating springs and crystals, but they don't really have anything to do with life.
Exactly right. And a particularly serious problem is all these experiments or these simulations, they basically use the same materials. Like, it's the same type of bead, it's the same type of spheres. And the problem with life is you've got completely different reactions. You have like hundreds of reactions taking place, which are completely different. And they require different chemical conditions, they require different physical conditions. And what happens is the enzymes are designed to fold into the right three-dimensional shape, to have the right properties, to create these miniature little environments that allows the reactions to move forward. And then what happens is the enzyme will force a specific reaction to take place. But because all of these reactions and processes are so different, you need a separate machine, a separate matching for every single one of them. And that's really a major problem that has not been addressed in England's research.
Yeah, this is a big deal, Brian. I'm glad you mentioned that, because there's a tendency to think that if we can just get the right kinds of things in the test tube, then they will react and we'll end up with the origin of life. I mean, I'm oversimplifying that, but there's kind of that naive tendency in origin of life research. And yet these machines have to be doing something that normally would not happen by itself in the absence of those machines. Is that right?
That's a great insight. In fact, what happens is some of the top origin of life researchers are coming to that same conclusion. Like, Michael Russell is one of the leading experts on this idea of a hydrothermal vent that's producing proton gradients that could power life. And he has some beautiful papers where he talks about how what life does is it basically drives processes that are taken out of the hands of chemistry. That's his words. Because what chemical processes will do is not what's useful to life. So you have to have machinery, and he states this, a separate machine dedicated to every single process you wish to make happen.
Okay, I love that term. Take life out of the hands of chemistry and manage it with machines. That's excellent. And so even if we had some of this quote-unquote order arising, how does it help with the information problem?
Right, and that's the key problem, is that if you look at sort of the self-organizational processes that could happen, they have no relationship to what's useful to life. That's the big challenge. So what happens is, as we just mentioned, is you've got to force reactions to take place that go against what nature would ever do. So you've got to have enzymes that force that to happen. And the reason enzymes do that properly is because of the sequence of amino acids. So it's basically the information in the sequence of amino acids that will cause it to fold in such a way to constrain the outcomes to what life needs. So it all goes back to information.
Right. Well, thank you, Brian. That's about all the time we have for today. It's been really great to have you here with us to help us better understand some of the issues and challenges with this proposal. And if possible, I'd love to have you back to continue our discussion.
I would love to do that.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of ID the Future. To learn more about the origin of life and the evidence for design and purpose in nature, be sure to join us regularly at idthefuture.com or on your favorite podcast app. As always, if you find these discussions to be a valuable contribution to the public conversation about origins, consider sharing an episode with a friend or leave a positive review on your podcast app of choice. For ID the Future, I'm Eric Anderson. Thanks for listening.
Does new evidence of cosmic design fascinate you? If so, check out the new book from philosopher of science and best-selling author Stephen Meyer, Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe. The science is airtight, and at the same time it's written so that non-scientists can follow the argument and see the many amazing ways modern physics and cosmology point to a grand designer of life and the universe. Check out the glowing endorsements from Nobel laureate Brian Josephson and others at returnofthegodhypothesis.com. That's returnofthegodhypothesis.com. That site also gives you links to Amazon and other booksellers that are selling the book. Pick up your copy today at returnofthegodhypothesis.com.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.